Coming up on the program today, who might say what at which confirmation hearing? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, January the 10th. Glad as always to have you with us, everybody. The truth is there are so many confirmation hearings going on in Washington this week. You got to pick and choose which ones you're going to cover. Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions in front of his colleagues on the Judiciary Committee today, examining his qualifications to be Attorney General, as you know. And then tomorrow, former Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson, President-elect Trump's nominee to be Secretary of State. Mr. Tillerson, of course, a former oil company executive, soon to be first among equals in a cabinet and a White House that is at best deeply skeptical about climate change. Views Mr. Tillerson does not necessarily agree with. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim gets us going on that disconnect.
There's still a lot of uncertainty when it comes to the Trump administration's policies on climate change. He's appointed several climate change skeptics, but then there's also Rex Tillerson. Kevin Book is managing director of Clearview Energy Partners.
If we assume that the Trump administration is full of climate deniers, then it would be safe to say that Rex Tillerson looks like he has a more nuanced, more accommodative view of global climate policy.
Tillerson accepts that carbon emissions have a warming impact. He just believes technological advances will provide an answer. Under his watch, ExxonMobil has signaled openness to a carbon price, like a tax. And the company also eventually backed the Paris Accords, a global agreement to limit carbon emissions. But that was Tillerson a week ago. Barry Rabe is a senior non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution.
How that would translate into what a Secretary of State Tillerson might do with any kind of a climate policy or American engagement in the Paris Accords is really unclear at this point, which is why these confirmation hearings hopefully really shed some significant light on that.
Rave says one thing he's keeping an ear open for is whether there'll be a discussion of a national carbon price, though he says it's unlikely a Trump administration would implement one. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Skipping ahead just a tad in the confirmation palooza that is upon us, Thursday is going to see Wilbur Ross, the pick for Commerce Secretary, headed to Capitol Hill for his hearings. Ross has decades of experience as an investor in distressed companies, buying failed or failing companies, and in most cases, turning them around, often by cutting jobs along the way. It might be, though, Mr. Ross's views on international trade that make him an interesting choice for Commerce. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
The Commerce Department oversees many things. The Patent Office, the Bureau of Economic Research, which calculates the trade deficit, and even NOAA, which does a lot of climate change research. But there's one section in the Commerce Department where Wilbur Ross has been before.
They have a major division that focuses on trade enforcement.
Kent Hughes is a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Wilbur Ross in the early 2000s bought up failing textile companies and steel mills and then lobbied the government to impose tariffs and penalties against Chinese competitors.
From his experiences in the steel industry, he knows that China cheats.
Leo Girard is president of the Steelworkers Union, which backs Ross's nomination.
He was very committed to a strong domestic manufacturing industry.
But where some see support for manufacturers, others see a dangerous misreading of international economics.
It's quite possible that he would bring a much more sort of protectionist, nationalistic approach.
Dan Eikenson is with the Cato Institute. He says the Commerce Department has a lot of discretion in judging whether other countries are violating trade rules and whether they should be punished with tariffs.
The Commerce Secretary could welcome more U.S. industries to bring petitions that result in the application of duties.
Duties and tariffs, whether deserved or not. The risk is that this invites retaliation from trading partners and raises prices for U.S. producers and consumers. The benefit is it might protect U.S. manufacturers. Whichever way you look at it, Wilbur Ross in a Trump White House will have significant leverage over U.S. trade policy. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Some energy policy. Now, the state of New York is going to find itself facing a big energy test in about 5 or 6 years. It has just announced the phasing out, that is the shutting down of a big nuclear plant just up the Hudson River from New York City. But it's not like that state's energy needs are going to go down, right? So it, that is New York, now has to replace all the power somehow, and it has committed to doing so in a low-carbon way. This is a scenario that is going to play out across the country as more and more aging nuclear plants find themselves on the energy endangered list. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The Indian Point nuclear plant in New York has had its problems. Radioactive elements leaked, a transformer exploded, and bolts were found missing. But it also faces a broader challenge for nuclear energy plants in general, rising costs for safety precautions after 9/11 and after the Fukushima disaster in Japan. Analyst James Lucier is with Capital Alpha Partners.
Nuclear power plants have had to increase not only their security post 9/11, but when you also have to start putting in seismic protection and other things to keep plants going, that's just a steady pattern of increasing costs.
And they're making less money, as stiff competition from cheap natural gas drives down electricity prices. Jesse Jenkins at the MIT Energy Initiative says up to half the country's nuclear fleet may be in the red.
The outlook for the time being is you know, relatively cheap natural gas. And then on top of that, in certain markets, the growth of renewable energy and lowering costs of wind and solar energy makes the long-term outlook even more challenging.
So when nuclear plants close, filling the big energy hole will be the test. New York's plan is to cut energy demand with things like more efficient buildings. Jackson Morris is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
And then once you reduce that overall demand through energy efficiency and a smarter grid, you can then fill up that space with as many renewables as possible.
Many states will be watching to see if New York can pull it off. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, nope, no 20K. But here's a hint. It's all psychological anyway. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's football news to share today. Actual football, not the elongated spheroid-based game that we play here. Soccer's international governing body, FIFA, has decided to increase the number of teams in the World Cup tournament from 32 to 48. It's going to make FIFA a whole lot more money. We're talking nine zeros more here. But it is worth remembering that FIFA is often preceded by the words scandal-plagued. Victor Matheson is a professor of economics and a soccer fan at the College of the Holy Cross. Professor, thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's tough to look past this as anything other than money, 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 and $1 billion, right?
Well, that's right. Although if you're a fan of Panama soccer, you're really looking forward to the next World Cup.
Right. That's because, in theory, more small nation teams are going to get into the finals now, right?
Right. So if you look back at what happened in 2014, the sort of teams that were the last teams out are places like Burkina Faso, Jordan, Uzbekistan, Panama. They would all be on the world stage if only there were 48 instead of 32 teams there.
How much of this do you think, though, is FIFA trying and you know, power to them for trying, but trying to get past all the scandal of the past, you know, decades with the corruption and all of that?
Well, certainly they're trying to turn over a new leaf here. This is a good way to spread some goodwill, especially among all those smaller, maybe less soccer-prone nations across the world. And it certainly is nice from FIFA's standpoint to have something besides scandal on the front page.
Yeah, but here's the thing. If everybody's in the playoffs, and I understand that 48 countries is not everybody, but if the playoffs are more inclusive, then is anybody really in the playoffs, if you take my meaning?
Yeah, there's several issues here. Number one, it makes all the individual confederation playoffs much less interesting. If your South American qualification, essentially every country but one or two is going to qualify for the World Cup. That doesn't make for very interesting qualifications there. If you're the United States and if North America has five different teams in the games here, well, then all of a sudden the United States is almost a lock to get in. It certainly makes all of those preliminary games pretty unexciting.
Do you imagine that with a longer tournament, right, it's going to be 80 games in total, I suppose, you know, television revenue is going to go up and everybody will, in theory, profit?
Well, the issue here is, although they do have 16 more games, they actually probably have less premier games than they did before because the big countries won't be playing against each other until fairly late in the tournament. So unlike the last games where we had big matches like England, Italy in the opening rounds, those aren't going to happen until later. And you're going to have a lot of Panama, Uzbekistan, or Egypt, Tunisia instead of those kind of premier games early.
Fans are still going to watch, though. I mean, you know.
Well, so fans are going to watch, but obviously you have a preference for watching your own country, and there's only so many additional eyeballs you can get from New Zealand or from Iceland.
You going to watch?
Of course I'm going to watch. As a matter of fact, I'm going to have to take June off just like usual.
Victor Matheson is a professor of economics at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Mass. Professor, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Well, thanks for having me.
Condé Nast is going to be saying goodbye to one of its long-running magazines next month, the print edition of it, at least. Self, one of the first women's magazines to focus on well-being over beauty, has been on newsstands for 38 years. From now on, though, it's going to be digital only, joining other magazines that have announced they're pulling the plug on print, including Mental Floss and Complex. Marketplace's Rima Kreis looks at this moment in magazines.
I'm at a newsstand in Los Angeles, standing next to a couple who, like me, are casually scanning the hundreds of titles. Harvey Marcus says, he probably won't buy one.
I don't think they're worth the money.
Not worth the money, he says. And get this, he actually knows a thing or two about the business.
I work for a magazine called Schön.
Yeah, he's an editor for a London-based magazine about fashion and art. And his girlfriend, Cassie Steer, she used to be a beauty director for the magazine InStyle UK. So what are they doing here in L.A.?
I'm out here because InStyle closed just before Christmas, so I've got some time off.
InStyle UK's circulation was dwindling, so it shut down its print edition, and now it's a digital-only brand. One of the casualties was Steer's job.
I was sad because it's a reflection of how everything's going.
Magazines are dying, I'm sorry to say.
Yes, some magazines do die, but for every death, four new ones are born. Rebecca Sterner is a longtime magazine consultant.
Nothing ever dies. It doesn't, no form of media really goes away. It changes.
Sterner says since the recession, many print magazines have seen drops in advertisement revenue, about 15% over the last few years, according to eMarketer.
It's meant a lot of staff layoffs, really negotiating hard with their vendors for paper and printing.
And in most cases, putting a lot more time and energy into other platforms.
They have to have a digital presence. That's the expectations of my audience nowadays.
Samir Hosni directs the Magazine Innovation Center at the University of Mississippi. He says it's not just about digital versus print, because there's an audience for both. Hosni says the industry's real issue is its over-reliance on advertising for revenue, a business model he calls outdated.
We are still seeing subscriptions given away for $5 for an entire year, which in my book should be a crime. On the one issue on the newsstand is almost the same price.
That helps explain why newsstand sales have plunged by double digits every year for the last 6 years. But the bookazines, they're selling well. Those are the glossy, thick, special editions with an average price of $14. Husni says the cheap magazines touting the latest news and celebrity gossip, they're out.
Social media took that role. Each one of those celebrities have their own social media. They will let you know before anybody else whether they are pregnant or not.
Today, some of the most successful magazines are hyper-focused. So it's not just about fishing, it's about saltwater fishing. And it's not just about healthy eating.
It's 100 fast meals for people with diabetes.
Doug Coma is the editorial content director for Meredith Core Media. He says other popular magazines tend to have a strong brand identity. That's why his company recently launched the Magnolia Journal. It's a lifestyle magazine from the couple that hosts HGTV's hit show, Fixer Upper.
Are y'all ready to see your Fixer Upper?
We are. Yes.
Let's do it.
Oh, my God.
Unbelievable.
Wow.
Something else that's unbelievable, when the issue hit the shelves late last year, Coma says retailers sold out of the 400,000 copies so quickly, the publisher had to go back to press.
This would have been even a standout performance 15 years ago.
He says it goes to show people are willing to pay for magazines that speak to them. Case in point, Milton Maristello.
This is a new magazine called Attitude. $19.95.
At the newsstand in L.A., he flips through dozens of magazines.
Oh, gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous.
At a time when the media landscape feels more crowded than ever, it's the Milton Maristellas of the world the magazine business is banking on. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Coming up.
This is what has everybody really concerned. Productivity growth is down to about 0.5% a year.
Sounds wonky, but it's not the downside of decreased productivity growth straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave back 0.1% today, 31 points, closed at 19,855. The NASDAQ, though, had another record day, packed on 0.3%, about 19 points, 55.51. The S&P 500 flat ended pretty much right where it started, 22.68. Bank earnings are going to come later in the week, and expectations are high, so why wait to celebrate, huh? Bank of America tuned up nearly 2% today. Wells Fargo Bank, 0.7%. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited about 0.25%. Retail, though, a different story. Reports that Walmart is going to cut hundreds of jobs this month, push shares in the discount giant down 0.2%. Macy's, the leader of the bad news parade, slid another 0.4% today. Target was flat. Verizon confirmed it is still going to buy Yahoo, now renamed, or soon, I suppose, to be renamed Altaba, about which, what? Verizon shares up 0.1% today. Yahoo shares rose more than 2%. Bonds were steady. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 2.37%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A story now that's a little bit real estate, a little bit supply and demand, and a little bit tetrahydrocannabinol, THC in clinical terms, pot, marijuana in the vernacular. Jeff Sessions, as I said, the nominee to be Attorney General for President Trump, said when asked at his confirmation hearing today about recreational marijuana use, he said he would never agree not to enforce federal laws, drug laws in particular. But in a not small and growing number of states, including California, recreational marijuana use is legal. That said, legal does not always mean readily available. And as always in business and economics, you got to be aware of the unintended consequences. From KQED in San Francisco, Sam Harnett has the story.
Sure, it's legal to smoke marijuana in California. But if you're trying to find a place to sell it, good luck, says Aaron Herzberg, partner of a Southern California real estate firm.
It's a needle in the haystack.
In places like the city of San Jose, local governments have banned the sale of recreational marijuana. Other cities say marijuana businesses must be a certain distance from schools and community centers. Herzberg says that's making prices skyrocket.
We own a dispensary in the city of Santa Ana, and in order to buy that building, we paid close to double market value.
In other states that have legalized recreational marijuana, real estate analysts have noted widespread impacts, like falling warehouse vacancy rates in Colorado or an uptick in commercial prices in southern Oregon. In California, the rising demand and prices of real estate have so far been more localized, but also dramatic.
It really took off quickly.
Aaron Johnson is a real estate lawyer in Monterey County, a big agricultural region. The county government is allowing certain old greenhouses to be used for marijuana cultivation.
Literally within a period of 2 weeks, I saw the prices go from $50,000 an acre for undeveloped industrial land to about $300,000 an acre.
When it comes to places for selling marijuana, there are many factors that have made real estate prices rise. You can see all those forces at work in a city like San Francisco, where Al Shawa runs a medical marijuana dispensary.
You'll walk in and you will have a huge display for people to look at what we're selling.
Shawa's dispensary is 4,000 square feet. Any commercial space that big will cost you. This is San Francisco. And Shawa's place is also far enough away from schools to qualify for a permit to sell cannabis. Shawa says he only got into the marijuana business after discovering his building just happened to meet the requirements. He used to sell clothing.
I was a retailer. I wasn't even smoking it when I was young.
Now in his old clothing store, Shawa has a booming medical marijuana business.
We started with 13 products. Now we have over 300.
Hundreds of products. This is another reason for increasing pressure on commercial marijuana real estate. Cannabis is more commodified than ever. Retailers need lots of space to market their growing number of products. Andrew Hopkins is a sales associate at Chawa's Dispensary.
We have all of our buds on display right in the middle. White caps are going to be sativa, more the peppy kind.
There is lots of stuff to sell. Now, this whole jump in real estate prices is anticipatory, given how much money there is to be made in the marijuana business. The research firm ArcView Group estimates California's cannabis industry could grow to $6.5 billion by 2020, making California by far the largest market for legal marijuana in the world. In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
One of the basic measurements of the health and the potential of this economy is worker productivity, economic efficiency. In the most basic terms, it's widgets produced per hour worked. The thing is, until literally just the past couple of months, productivity gains have been anemic to non-existent in this economy, just a 0.5% annual increase on average over the past 5 years. That matters because rising productivity, more widgets per hour worked, is a key driver of rising wages for workers, better profits for businesses, and in theory, higher standards of living. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports from our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, some economists are now saying that slower productivity growth may be here to stay.
Following a 20th century packed with monumental technological leaps, major improvements in productivity in the U.S. economy have now basically stalled out. That's the argument made by Northwestern University economist Robert Gordon in his 2016 book, The Rise and Fall of American Growth. To demonstrate, Gordon asks us to imagine American life more than a century ago.
In 1870, you had a house that was completely isolated from the outside world. By 1930, almost all urban houses were connected five different ways through electricity, gas, telephone, running water, and waste disposal. So it wasn't just a matter of the factory working more efficiently. It was an utter change in the standard of living.
Gordon says after World War II, new technology kept revolutionizing the economy. Automation to speed up assembly lines, highways and jets to move goods more efficiently, new metals and chemicals to extend the lives of machines and consumer goods. And most Americans reaped the benefits. Productivity rose 3% a year. Wages rose strongly. Workers could afford new houses, cars, power tools, and gas ranges. Then, in the 1970s, productivity slowed way down. Middle-class wages stagnated. And now, says Gordon,
this is what has everybody really concerned. Productivity growth is down to about 0.5% a year, 1/6 of what we once were able to achieve.
And why does this matter? Because when productivity slows, businesses don't generate much extra capital to boost workers' pay. But I asked Gordon, what about today's cutting-edge digital technologies?
My name is Siri.
Aren't smartphones and supercomputers, gene splicing, MRIs, Google, and Facebook delivering enough economic oomph to boost productivity and living standards?
When people use Facebook, that does not create more jobs and it does not allow business firms to pay workers higher wages. It's something that consumers enjoy, just as they enjoyed television in a generation before that.
Now, Gordon has his critics. Jonathan Rothwell is senior economist at Gallup.
We haven't run out of ideas. You know, lack of technological innovation isn't really the thing holding us back.
So what is? Rothwell blames stagnation in dominant sectors like education and healthcare, where big market players and trade associations get regulations passed
that make their businesses more profitable but make it harder for others to enter and compete with them.
Economist Martin Bailey at the Brookings Institution thinks in time, new technology can overcome a lot of these obstacles.
So the medical care sector is one with a huge amount of innovation. We still don't take into account how much benefit we're getting from the new drugs, the new surgical procedures. I think artificial intelligence now is starting to make very considerable progress.
All that new technology, says Robert Gordon?
It's evolutionary, but it's not revolutionary.
Meaning it's not likely to transform work, jumpstart productivity, and pump up paychecks the way electricity and the personal computer once did. And that, Gordon says, leaves today's young workers in the cold.
their parents were growing up in this period of more rapid productivity growth. And now more and more children are arriving in their 20s and 30s without the kinds of income their parents had at the same ages.
Not a recipe for raising America's standard of living in the future. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. First of all, Clemson, huh? Huh? Told you. But enough about me. Turns out the university's finance folks had an inkling last night would turn out well, too. Back in the fall, Clemson spent $272,000 in premiums to ensure the bonuses that the team's coaches would be due if the Tigers had won last night saved them $1.2 million after that last-second touchdown. All right, we got to go. The Dow gave back a 10% today, 31 points, 19,855 on the blue chips. NASDAQ, another record day, up 0.3%, 19 points, 55.51. The S&P 500 flat, 22.68, right where it began. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.